Hello, listeners, and welcome to a new episode of the Squawker Talker Football Podcast. My name is Jake Entwistle, and catching up with you after a week of FIFA ratings and international fixtures, we'll be returning to look at club football, especially the Premier League. And joining me in those discussions themselves is returning chief writer at Squawker, Mohammed Butt. Welcome, Mo.
Hey, Jay, I'm excited. You know, the international break was surprisingly good. Lots of great games. De Bruyne, you know, Bernardo, Sturridge, basically Man City players.
Yeah, basically. Well.
And, you know, occasionally the odd England player or even a Dortmund player, but of course we're not talking about that.
Yes, it was good fun, the international break. Plenty of high-scoring games.
England, well done, Kosovo, I have to say.
Yes. Excellent. Well, England ended their streak. So England are favourites now for Euro 2020, I think, just of beating Kosovo 5-3. And also returning, just two guests for me today. But returning is a man that has been spending all week ranking the best songs ever on FIFA. Mr. Tom Green returns. How has that been treating you?
A lot of good songs, a lot of memories, a lot of reminiscing. That article will hopefully drop later today or tomorrow, so check that out. It'll be on the Squawker timeline or on the Squawker website.
Are you confident in your picks?
I'm confident there'll be a lot of controversy around some of the picks, but I think overall people should agree with the general structure of the list.
Subjectivity at its finest, I think.
I love that.
Music choice.
Confidence in your choices, mate. I like it.
You might not agree with some, but the general, I've got it right, mainly, 75%. And if you don't agree, you're wrong. But we are not going to be discussing those FIFA songs on this podcast. As Tom said, that'll be an article for you to consume at another point. We are starting with Premier League football and looking ahead, as we said. No predictions to run over from last week because we did our Champions League special. So you've still got a week to listen to that as well. So make sure you do that. But obviously this year and this season, the podcast is sponsored by BetBull. And you'll find predictions each week, an accumulator, which will be in the description of the podcast. Follow Squawker on BetBull to look at our predictions. As we said, we'll be doing the Champions League group winners. That was from last week's podcast. This week, we'll be returning to our weekend accumulator. And one game that will feature on that accumulator is the battle of the huge-headed centre-backs at Old Trafford. Harry Maguire and Kalar Soyuncu meet, and it seems that in the first four games of the season, which, as we know, is a humongous sample size, and we can base full analysis on those four games, Leicester fans are actually quite happy with how that Maguire deal turned out, Mo.
I mean, obviously, short sample size and everything, but they appear to have played this very well. You know, they're obviously, you never want to lose a player like Maguire, but, you know, when you do, make 80 million quid, probably the way to lose a player like that. And then they brought him in beforehand, and then you bring through this younger, much cheaper player who seamlessly replaces him. I mean, it's small sample size. Let's see how it pans out over an entire season. But so far, very, very good. And, you know, also he has a massive head. And that's important. You need to keep your head size, you know, a quota about the same.
If you're going to be consistent, although when I was looking at stat comparisons after the first four game weeks, Maguire still comes out very strong, which is sort of surprising given the relative negativity surrounding Man United's start to the season, apart from that 4-0.
Yeah, but if you've watched...
I was most surprised to see that Harry Maguire weighs 100 kilograms, which is 18 more than Soyuncu.
See, this is where you need to talk about density. It's like planets, you know what I mean? Like, which planet is more dense? It's not about necessarily size, about what they're made of. And obviously, Harry Maguire's head is made of a far denser material than Soyuncu's. But I tell you why Maguire's done really well stats-wise, and the same reason why Wan-Bissaka's done well stats-wise is because United's midfield is terrible. And essentially, United bought these two players because they're really, really good defenders, elite defenders, you would argue, and they've had to be, essentially. Like, if they hadn't bought those two, United would have lost every game this season. Basically, it's as simple as that. Their midfield is a joke, and people walk through it like it's not even there. Pogba is, when he's playing well, he's like, what the hell are you guys doing? And when he's not playing well, he's just sort of ambling around the field, looking lost. And it's just a disaster, really. And luckily for United, they did buy these two. But even then, it's quite funny because Wan-Bissaka's been really, really, really good. Maguire's been really, really, really good. And yet United have still managed to mess up defensively because De Gea letting a goal at his near post against Palace. And then,
yeah, the near post is not necessarily the wrong thing.
And Victor Lindelof, though, that's the immediate thing. He was so solid back in the last season. He's now come up, been exposed, really exposed twice in the air by first Jeffrey Schlupp and then again by Yannick Vestergaard. And that's cost United points.
If you're getting exposed in the air by Yannick Vestergaard, I think you can almost be forgiven slightly.
Kind of, but then when it comes off the back of being done by Jeffrey Schlupp as well. Mm. And it was, and also if you watch it, it wasn't so much that he went out for a challenge and got bested. That would have been like, okay, fine, the guy's enormous. You look at it, Maguire is standing in front of Vestergaard. He points to Lindelof and says, look, mark him. And Lindelof, instead of stepping forward and trying to deal with him, he does the same thing as Maguire and just points behind him and tries to pass him on to someone else.
Someone needs to be taking leadership in that defence. Just go and head it yourself. Lindelof is an interesting one because he seems to be in a massive peak or a huge trough in terms of what people's opinion of him. He'll start the season really well and you'll see everyone tweeting about his stats and being really positive, and then he'll make one mistake and it's like, goes back to when, you remember when Jamie Carragher completely went in on him and said, I just don't think he's good enough at all for the Premier League, let alone Man United.
Yeah, I think that's a bit unfair. I think he's very, very good. I just think he has a weakness in the air. I think it's always been apparent. Last season he played with Chris Smalling, so it wasn't a bigger deal. This season playing with Harry Maguire. So again, for the most part, it's not a big deal because they're the ones dominating the ball. But occasionally he can get isolated in the air, and he's not very for Sweden, he plays with Granqvist, you know, also great in the air. So he's never had to be the main guy to head the ball away, right? And so I think sometimes if you can isolate him, which teams are going to start to do now often, you can expose him. It's not that he's terrible, it's just that he has one very pronounced weakness and teams are clocking onto that. I don't know how he works at getting better in the air other than just practicing at it, I guess, but you know, that's where United really would wish that Eric Bailly's limbs weren't made of like plasticine, because you know he's a player who doesn't have any weakness except injury. Like, so him and Maguire would be a phenomenal duo, but Bailly is always injured, so I don't know.
I think glass is the material that is usually associated with
Well, I mean, you can go
injury prone player,
cardboard, polystyrene.
The thing is, though, talking about Lindelof and maybe that weakness in the air, and as you said, some holes still in that Man United defence at times. They have actually got one of the best defences in the league in terms of expected goals against. They've not necessarily played anyone that has looked to attack them to any extent. Chelsea in the first half was probably the only game where it's been a sort of to and throw between two teams and Man United really penned in. But apart from that, they've looked genuinely fairly comfortable at restricting their opponents to any decent chances. The problem is, and this probably again stems from your point you made about the midfield, Mo. So the midfield is one, making the defence having to defend more, which they're doing very well. As we said, Wan-Bissaka's made the most tackles, and that shouldn't be a stick to beat him with. He is literally just shutting down anyone that tries to go down that side.
I mean, basically, he's been beaten like twice, I think.
So he's just doing his job because there's a porous midfield in front of him. And then when you look forward, Man United, apart from, in terms of expected goals, if you take out penalties, they're not ranking too highly, despite this idea that if you were going to take expected goals against and expected goals, they'd be sitting quite high and pretty up at the table. What strikes me watching United at the moment is that there's still no real identity in terms of attack, and there's no real way to break any teams down. You look at their ability to counter-attack, and they showed that to perfection against Chelsea. They scored three incredibly high quality chances on the counter-attack against Chelsea to win that 4-0. However, and we spoke about it when we previewed the Wolves game, when their team is like, try and break us down, they still look unable to do so. And then this leans into the fact that how do they set up an attack with the players they've got to score goals against a team that will defend deep. We've seen Martial seems to be the number nine this season. Rashford is in sort of, not a crisis in terms of his career, but this is the first time he's been questioned about whether he's good enough to play as a number nine, or whether he should play somewhere else, or whether he shouldn't be in the team at all. And we actually had a listener's question that says, is versatility for an individual player a curse? Chama Lubansa, I'm sorry if I've got that wrong, on Twitter, says, is versatility for an injured player an advantage or a disadvantage? I asked this question with players like Danilo, Sergio Roberto, Eric Dier, and Marcus Rashford in mind. So is Marcus Rashford versatile, or is he just not as good as everyone else in certain positions? Is there a certain way you can look at it?
I mean, yeah, look, he is versatile. First of all, he can play pretty much all across the front three to a reasonable level. And that is a problem sometimes, because what happens is, first of all, I do think actually the intention was to have clear positions. Rashford was going to be left winger, Martial was going to be number nine, took the number nine shirt back, and then Dan James, Mason Greenwood, whatever, would be the right winger. So that was obviously the idea for this season. And then Martial got injured, so they had to put Rashford up front. And I think what we see with Rashford is he is kind of versatile. And I think that does hurt you in a way if you're a developing player and you have potential to be elite, you know, in a position. And like Rashford's ability to cover, it means that whenever they need cover, they're, instead of, because they haven't got a deep squad, when they need cover, instead of saying, okay, Martial's out injured, let's bring in our backup forward, they'll link with Sebastian Haller, let's bring in Haller, or let's bring in Llorente, they'll link with, you know, or just someone, some kind of backup striker. No, what they do is they pull Rashford out of left wing and now he's playing up front again. But he's been trained to play left wing the whole time. So what are you doing to him? That's going to hurt his development. The same thing happened to Wayne Rooney, actually, quite a lot. If you remember Wayne Rooney, when he first broke through, he was just an unstoppable force of nature, number 10, second striker, playing off, not necessarily a target man, just another striker. So like, with Michael Owen for England, and then he came to United, it was Ruben Nistelrooy. And what happened was, he was such a hard worker defensively and such a good, versatile player that Sir Alex Ferguson started playing him left wing to cover for Ryan Giggs' aging legs and then eventually for Cristiano Ronaldo. And what happened was, Rooney had an amazing, amazing career, but having to be saddled with this extra work and defensive responsibility kind of took the magic out of Rooney's game. If you look at him in elder years, there's only flashes of young Rooney where he could do anything. Mm. And part of that was his own lifestyle as well. But his versatility did hurt him. And so, yeah, with Rashford, it's going to keep hurting him until United sign a squad capable to just let him play. Okay, you're a left winger, you be left winger. Or even your number nine, be number nine. But I think in the way that United are playing, especially against teams that sit deep, he's much better suited to being a winger. Because as Gareth Southgate said in midweek after the England games, when he can get his head up and run at people, that's where he's at his most dangerous. You don't put him with his back to goal because he's not necessarily great at that. Martial, on the other hand, is great at that. He can muscle with defenders, put his back to goal with those little flick-ons that strikers do. So it's just another symptom of United's poor squad building. They needed to sign an attacker to go back, bring it all back to the whole, why can't they break teams down? It's because they don't have a distinct pattern of play. The idea of the players that they have, the patterns of play they can work, are all on the break.
Yeah.
They had no sort of automatic, like, you know, the Barca move to the left wing for the Jordi Alba cross, or, you know, any sort of recognised pattern of play, like the Man City ping, 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 pass inside the fullback, low cross across the goal, tap in for someone. You know, they don't have any sort of signature goal like that. And when they had the ball, so when you sit deep, they just start freewheeling it. And sure, sometimes that works. Pogba does something amazing. Daniel James has scored a couple of really nice goals. You can score a goal that way, but it's not a reliable way to do it. And the only way to get that to really would have been for United to sign a number 10. That's a bit of a cheat, because it's not like he really makes something, but because if you have a ball dominant number 10, they draw the ball into them and you end up accidentally creating patterns of play just because they always get the ball. So like Eriksen, if it was Eriksen they signed, he would have been drifting into that inside right channel, getting the ball a lot, putting crosses in, and they would have developed patterns of play based off that alone. But they didn't sign a number 10. And that's why their attack just looks so all over the place. This game actually will probably be better for them than the previous three, because Leicester will come and attack them. Leicester will have a go. So there'll be space for them to, even if not, like, they won't be wide open on the break, there'll be spaces for them to attack and run into. Whereas Palace and Wolves, they were just like, nah, mate, you can attack.
Yeah,
we're going
to
chill.
I mentioned Crystal Palace's approach away from home relative to how Arsenal were trying to adopt that in terms of just sitting back and being counter-attacking efficient. And that's what they did at Old Trafford and broke many records with that win, their first Premier League win against Man United. But as you said, it's Leicester that visit Old Trafford this weekend. And Leicester, alongside Man City and Liverpool, are the only unbeaten team left in the Premier League. So good company for Brendan Rodgers' side there. And it seems, I think in our predictions podcast, Will made the case for, it was Everton and Leicester we made cases for of being the big six challengers, wasn't it, this season? I think, I can't remember which way it switched and who we decided on. I think we said Will's Everton shout was fair, but we made a strong case for Leicester.
The Leicester thing was all dependent on how they would replace Maguire, yeah. And we thought they hadn't done that because they hadn't signed
Dunk. We mentioned Cianci.
Yeah, but we thought they were chasing Dunk and Duffy or whatever, but no, they've done it from within. So, I mean, I think they are a very good shout.
So
to break in.
The thing to round up this section was just going through just a 1-11 of Man United and Leicester in the sense that the reason why we decided to put this in was that when I was looking at Wan-Bissaka and I was resharing an article we wrote about why his tackling is good for him but not good for Man United, is that second for most tackles is Ricardo Pereira, who is obviously Leicester's right back. So then we thought it'd be good just to rush through position by position and including manager, who you would pick from Man United Leicester. So it's almost like a quick combined 11 of the both, but just to get a gauge of whether it's individual talent or whether Leicester's team play is actually what making them better than Man United. Because in terms of patterns, Jamie Vardy, Tielemann and Maddison are a joy to watch when they're playing together. So without further ado, we'll start with goalkeeper. An out of form David De Gea, and you can put any spin, just think their peak form maybe right now, who would you pick, David De Gea or Kasper Schmeichel? Tom, we'll start with you.
On peak form, it's still got to be De Gea for me, despite the fact I love Kasper Schmeichel. But
I'm picking Kasper Schmeichel, right, because De Gea's not playing well right now, man.
Okay, I would go De Gea on that, because I think you still pick David De Gea. Based on that 2017-18 season alone,
I mean,
there's clearly
obviously
a goalkeeper there. So Aaron Wan-Bissaka versus Ricardo Pereira. Tom?
Well, I went for Wan-Bissaka for this one only because of his vast amounts of potential and the fact that he's already playing fantastic.
Wan-Bissaka, shut down corner, man.
I've put as a little note, one of the toughest decisions, but I'm such a fan of Aaron Wan-Bissaka, and just his mastery of 1v1 situations
in
itself is something that I would always sort of put in my leg. But that is not to say that Ricardo Pereira is perhaps one of the underrated right backs in the league, because a lot of focus has been on English right backs and the wealth of talent there. So the foreign imports in that position have been sort of overlooked.
But I would say Pereira is as good as any right back in the Premier League. You know, because they've all got their niches. Alexander Arnold obviously great with the ball, but not so great without it. I think
Pereira right ranks high, sort of runs parallel to Aaron Wan-Bissaka in terms of stats, especially last season, take-ons and all the 1v1 duels. The only thing that tipped it in Wan-Bissaka's favour is the success rate. So therefore, I think I'd pick Wan-Bissaka just for that, ever so slightly. Lindelof versus Johnny Evans at right centre back, and we've discussed Lindelof a bit.
Yeah, Johnny the killer. Johnny the
really?
Killer.
Really? So I put Lindelof because I still think he lulls people into thinking he can be great, but he's probably just good. And Johnny Evans has always been good.
He's
just
consistently solid, I think.
I just think age wise at the moment, if I was picking him now, I think I'd still go with Lindelof just. But it's good that you two have gone Leicester. And then Maguire versus Cianci. This is the one.
Oh, I'd go for Maguire.
Yeah, I'd still go for Maguire. I think he's still got the edge and he's got that, you know, the character and everything, the leadership. So
yeah, well, leadership. Well, he should have headed the ball away.
That's a fair point.
Shouldn't have given it to Lindelof.
That is a fair point.
I've gone for Maguire though as well, because although Cianci has been really interesting to see fill the void that Maguire left and has done it very well, I think Maguire, and when we looked at the stats and the comparisons of four games, he's still actually ranking really well, winning a lot of duels, very high percentage. So I think still Harry Maguire there just edges it at the moment. But come the end of the season, Cianci might be making a claim to be an £80 million centre-back himself. Left back, Luke Shaw, Ben Chilwell.
Chilwell.
Yeah, I think I've put easiest decision.
Yeah.
Ben Chilwell is England's left back for the next 10 years and probably Man City's for the next 5.
I mean,
You can imagine he's the sort of player Guardiola is looking at all the time, given homegrown and just genuine quality in that position. So formation-wise, I pitched it as a sort of... Leicester have been playing what you could call a 4-1-4-1, which obviously changes into a 4-3-3. Man United play 4-2-3-1 and sometimes 4-3-3. So what I've done is I've pit the sort of holding midfielder number 6 in the position and then done 2 centre midfielders. So in that holding number 6 sort of role, it seems to be Scott McTominay is Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. And he's going against Wilfried Ndidi.
Said Shaw versus Chilwell was the easiest decision, but for me it's this one. It's Ndidi every day.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not close.
Ndidi, Mr. Tackles and interceptions.
Yeah.
So if you want a screen in that role, definitely go for Ndidi. Although I saw Grace on Football wrote a preview about, or not a preview really, looking back at Man United's form this start of the season. And Scott McTominay's actually improved his numbers in that role as well.
He's okay, so, but he's not.
I just thought it was worth to mention that despite it being an easy decision.
Yeah, sorry, I wasn't.
No, I know you weren't.
I was just saying how good Ndidi is for me.
Yeah, exactly.
They're both much better than Emmanuel Matic. Let's put it that way.
So he would lose. And then let's go for the right centre midfielder. And then again, maybe he sort of played this role for England, so I guess you could put him there. But Jesse Lingard seems to be the choice for number 10 slash that role for Man United. So I've put him against Youri Tielemann there. They play the same role.
I'm going to have to go with Tielemann.
It's Tielemann, yeah.
Lingard has played 115 Premier League games and provided 10 assists. Tielemann has played 98 fewer and has 50% of those already. So I thought that was the choice in that respect. And obviously assists aren't the be-all and end-all, but what gets in the way of a good little stat like that? Nothing. I will never stop doing it. Left centre midfield, Paul Pogba, and someone that actually has played more minutes than you'd expect for Leicester, perhaps, someone that is very talented, Hamza Chowdhury, who it's probably even unfair to compare them because they will play different roles, but it's just the way it's been set up.
Well, if we're voting on who has the best hair, then I'm going to have to go with Chowdhury.
Yes.
But he's a
FIFA legend, isn't he, for his hair?
Yeah, so, the infamous afro on pro clubs. But yeah, I'm going to have to go with Paul Pogba for my combined next side, though.
Paul Pogba.
Yeah, I think I rarely ever pick any midfielder above Paul Pogba.
It's hard to, isn't it?
And
really?
It's funny that this midfield that we've just constructed there of Ndidi, Tielemann and Paul Pogba
is basically
might actually get the best out of Paul Pogba.
This is the kind of midfield United should have put around Paul Pogba, basically. This is the quality midfield, you know.
And then we've discussed midfielders without mentioning James Maddison, but interestingly, he's been playing out wide in this formation, and obviously that does not mean a winger. It means he's been put on the left, and this is why perhaps Southgate isn't even playing him for England. I know that was a lot of discussion in the international break. Maddison obviously still not made his debut.
Yeah.
Southgate preferring Mason Mount, but Mason Mount's been playing on the left as well. So you look at these sort of number 10s that are being used out wide while you have a more solid midfield. So left midfield, as we mentioned, could be left wing. Marcus Rashford, James Maddison. Different skill set, so it almost depends on the 11 you've built yourself already. Tom, who have you picked there?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of pace and running at the opposition's defence, you'd have to go for Rashford. But I think for this one, I am going to go for Maddison just for his fantastic creative ability.
Mo?
I'll go for Rashford. I think pace and if you put the right kind of team around him, he'll just destroy it.
Yeah, I've gone for Maddison because I need a set piece wizard in the team.
A fair point. Actually.
Imagine Pogba, Chilwell, and Maddison in that little left half space.
Yeah.
It'd be the most audacious half space the Premier League has ever seen. Flicks and tricks, and searing overlapping. So that's why I wanted Maddison there. And also, my Maddison pick relates to right midfield, so Daniel James versus Mark Albrighton.
Yeah, Dan James.
Well, yeah, I'll go with Daniel James. I do like Mark Albrighton, especially considering when he was released from Aston Villa, who then got relegated only to join Leicester and win the Premier League. It's probably one of my favourite stories ever.
And as well, Mark Albrighton, I think, could survive a genuine nuclear apocalypse because he's one of those players that isn't glamorous, but every manager seems to end up picking him because he's obviously just fills such an important role for that side. And talking about crossing ability, that should not go unnoticed. He's still a mainstay or an important part of that Leicester team is makes him way back in. But in the same way that I picked Maddison for creativity, it's because I knew I'd have Daniel James's pace on the right.
You're putting a team together.
So that's where I've built it out. And Daniel James has made a really impressive start to his Premier League career and scored another trade, almost becoming a trademark goal in the international break, cutting in from the left. And that's where, again, the Rashford... Is Daniel James the best left winger for Man United? We'll leave that for another time because we've spent plenty of time on this.
It's a spicy take, Jake, but
it is.
Are you wrong? I don't know.
We have one more position to fill, which is number 9, Martial versus Vardy. I thought this was pretty simple.
Vardy.
It's Vardy. Martial, better player, will potentially be better, but right now, for scoring goals...
And just up front, if you're just putting one striker there, Vardy, again, he's scored more Premier League goals than any player since Rodgers took over. So he's outside the top six. He's leading the way at the moment in terms of goal scoring and seems to have that finishing swagger back that he had during that Premier League title winning season as well. And then finally, just to finish this one off, if you were going to have a manager, Solskjaer or Brendan Rodgers?
Rodgers.
I love Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, but it's Brendan Rodgers.
Yes, yeah, I put Brendan Rodgers. And here's a little pun to finish. Brendan Rodgers created SAS. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer might soon be signalling SOS. Okay. And therefore, I've picked Brendan Rodgers. So were you keeping tally of that,
yeah,
Mark? I saw you
taking 7-5 to Leicester.
7-5
I mean, hope it's that score this weekend. That'll be great.
Well, that would be a fun game. We'll get onto the prediction for the scores in a moment. We're going to take a quick break and then we're going to visit Vicarage Road. One of the major occurrences in terms of Premier League during the international break was, of course, the sacking of Javi Gracia, despite being the first Watford manager under the Pozzo family to be given a new contract. In less than a year later, he has been removed from his position from the club after reaching an FA Cup final, the second in their history. They're the only club with not multiple points in the Premier League so far after four games. They just have one. They face Arsenal next. Watford, despite lulling us into the idea that they'd gone past those ways of cycling through managers, not only did they sack Javi Gracia, they brought back a manager that they previously had.
I mean, this is pure Pozzo family, isn't it? This is kind of mad. Look, Javi Gracia is a really, really, really good manager. I don't understand. It seems really odd. I mean, look, I know they ended last season with three straight league defeats and then City smacked fire out of them in the cup final. They got to the cup final, shocking Wolves on the way, but then they just got absolutely obliterated there. But three straight league defeats, and they started this season with three losses and one draw as well. I do think it's soon. I do think it's really harsh as well on Javi Gracia, because he's a really good coach and he's done a lot of good things with that squad, but it seems very early to me. Four games in?
It's almost too early in this season, but if it had happened at the end of last season, it would have been...
If they'd sacked him after this cup final, you'd been like, well, I mean, that's...
Oh, that would have been harsh.
It would have been harsh, but you'd have been like, yeah, I get it. They really tailed off at the end of the season, and the cup final was a disgrace. So, you know, yeah, okay, I kind of get that. It's a bit harsh, but I get it. Doing it now, four games in?
Ollie, that does some of the social shifts at the weekend for Scorecrate, is a Watford fan, and watching his agony seeing scores roll in at the weekend has been interesting. And it seems Watford fans are just annoyed at the fact that they broke their club record to sign Ismail Assar. He played in the cup game, scored immediately, and then there's been too much focus on a defensive side from Gracia in terms of team selection, and just not playing their most exciting players that they actually signed to make Watford fun to watch again. So that seemed one of the points from outside looking in at why they may have got rid of him as well. Until you look at what Kike Sanchez Flores said in his interview, which I don't think things are going to change, because he said... he was asked by the Watford interviewer, last time you were here, you said you wanted to be compact in a low block. Is that changed? And he said, no, I still don't want more than 35 to 40 metres between the defence and the attack. Defence is the most important thing in all collective sports. I follow NBA, and once the Toronto Raptors won, the coach was asked, what's the key? And he said, passion and defence.
And also scoring loads of points. What? No, come on.
Well, no, their own coach said it.
No, I know. The Toronto Raptors. Yeah, they shut down their Warriors.
What I'm saying is that Kike Sanchez Flores wants to be a solid side before he is an expansive side.
Yeah.
So maybe Watford fans, despite being angry at some of those team selections, they might not see any change with that. He did mention, though, that 4 years ago he just had Deeney and Ighalo up front and no one else. So he did say that he has a few more options, but he needs to work out how they mix together. So perhaps Watford, their start to the season, again, if we look at the expected goals and stuff, they probably don't deserve to be on one point, and therefore it seems like a sacking based on the table rather than what is happening on the pitch. But it has happened. The streak is not over. They are still sacking managers with extreme regularity, but... Kike Sanchez Flores returns, Tom. Is it going to be an improvement? We've said there that he's going to be a defensive output. Is he Does he offer anything more than Gracia offered to the team, do you think?
Well, interestingly enough, looking at the stats, comparing both managers during their time across all competitions at Watford, they similarly have a similar win rate, with Kike Sanchez Flores slightly lower at 36.36% compared to Javi Gracia's 37.9%. But if we break that down, Javi Gracia played 22 more games at 66 compared to Flores's 44, and that was then divided into 25 wins for Gracia and 16 wins for Flores. But like you said, sometimes it's not all about these sorts of numbers. So Kike Sanchez Flores wants to build that strong defence, and in fact managed to get 8 clean sheets in his first 17 league games for Watford during his first stint, which is exactly what they need right now. And going back to the streak that they're currently on, as a West Ham fan, considering West Ham beat them twice during this period, scoring 3 goals and 4 goals, which in itself, when West Ham are scoring 7 goals against you in 2 games, it's probably worrying.
So you deserve to be sacked for that alone, yeah. Is what you're saying.
I just think that Watford lack that main man at centre back. Every team has like their one regular centre back. I know they've got Cabasele, and then I know they bought Dawson in the window, but I feel as if centre back is a position where they lack, and in January they should be targeting getting another one
to make sure that low block is impenetrable from Kike Sanchez Flores. I think Cathcart was, again, quite impressive for them last season, almost became a bit of a fan favourite. Obviously, they face Arsenal in his first game. Vicarage Road was the only stadium Arsenal managed to get an away clean sheet last season.
I mean, yeah, that's not a difficult... It's not an easy opener, is it?
Thanks to Aubameyang closing down Ben Foster. So Arsenal didn't... In fact, Watford even had a man sent off and looked 10 times better than the Arsenal side. But things have changed a lot for both clubs this season. Obviously, the new manager, we can imagine then that it's going to be a defensive setup, especially as he's not had much time to work with the team.
And Arsenal got dancing men, Pepe and Ceballos. So it's going to require a lot of commitment from the Watford guys, because they're going to be jumping all over the place trying to keep track of it.
Abdoulaye Doucouré, who at one point was a £50 million target for many clubs, is drifting.
The talent is there,
quickly
the
talent, into the abyss.
The talent is there. You harness that talent, he's phenomenal. So, you know.
Interesting. We'll get on to predictions for Kike Sanchez Flores. Oh, it's so hard to do 3. You want to give him his full name, but it's so hard to do 3 names in a row.
He's got a nice scarf, though. So, I mean, the scarf game is going to be up.
So we'll be doing predictions for his first game in charge in the next section. We'll move quickly on to our final sort of Premier League focus game. And this will be purely, it's almost a player focus game, because as Mo mentioned in the intro to the podcast, Man City's players during the international break, De Bruyne, Sterling and Bernardo Silva specifically, scored 4 goals between them and provided 9 assists in 2 games each. Each getting 3 assists in 2 games, which was pretty scary if you're everyone else, because De Bruyne specifically is on course to obliterate every assist record written in the Premier League record book at the moment. And they face a Norwich side, and Will, again, who's not on the podcast today, picked out that Norwich are actually in the relegation zone. And despite so much praise being given to them, including by ourselves, for their style of play, they still only have that 1 win against Newcastle.
I love Norwich, but I'm really worried, conceding
a lot of goals.
I'm really worried they're going to go the way of, remember that Blackpool side under Ian Holloway that were really guys touched and got relegated? I'm really worried about Norwich.
And obviously they host Man City at the weekend. And as I said, with De Bruyne just not looking like he's slowing down, and Norwich not having the best of defence at times, and also having no defenders to actually use at Carrow Road this weekend, this could be one of the highest scoring games of the of the season.
Thomas Rudy in the office, Norwich fan, was saying, what was it, 9-0? He was joking. I don't think it'll be that, but it will be bad. It will be bad for Norwich because, they struggle to defend when they have defenders. They don't even have defenders. I do think long-term they will get it together and they'll have an easier run of games and they'll start winning. But right now they're struggling. City are... just, it's ridiculous how good they are. They're so, so good. And it's worth remembering that if they don't play Bernardo Silva, they bring in Riyad Mahrez, who I think has got like one of the most big chances created so far this season. And De Bruyne will play, and he's just out of this world right now.
I think Riyad Mahrez in the two games he has played has been arguably the best player on the pitch as well. Against West Ham, he was amazing. Yeah.
And like they can toss a coin, Aguero or Jesus. Mm. And I mean,
Aguero again. This it's classic Aguero.
Is top scorer, right?
Just as we were starting to say, we're not sure how many games he's going to play. He's scored in every game so far this season, and he's actually chasing. Oh, so I mentioned records that could be broken at Carrow Road, and it's the perfect fixture to do it. So let me just outline those. The most assists after five matches of a Premier League season, so not a player's first five games, the first five games of a season, is Thierry Henry with 7 in 2004-05, and Cesc Fabregas in 2014-15 with Chelsea with 6. De Bruyne, of course, is on 5 with a game to play. 2 and he equals Henry. 3 and he breaks it, and you wouldn't even put him past that. He got 3 against Scotland in the international break. And looks like he's probably going to at least equal Fabregas there. And then Sergio Aguero himself is chasing a record for most goals in the first five games, and is chasing Wayne Rooney from 2011-12. I think he needs a hat-trick to equal it. We know Aguero likes scoring 4 goals as well.
And Norwich are, you know, again, it's all perfectly set up for City to chase these records, whether or not they'll get close to them or not. But City, they're too good, man.
It's going to be an interesting match to watch just to follow those, because you'll be tallying. Yeah. You can imagine Man City will score. As we said, Norwich, the way they played against Liverpool, you can't imagine them. They're almost the antithesis of what we were talking about with Watford there.
Yeah.
So Flores has come in and said, I just need to defend, and we'll do well. Whereas we've seen from Farker and Norwich that we're going to play our football.
Yeah,
we'll score goals that way, and if we don't concede anyway, then we can win.
No compromise.
Well, going on to De Bruyne as well, just talking about how great he is, he was actually given the highest rated card in the Premier League for any player at 91. So,
and there was a lot of contention, wasn't there, about certain FIFA ratings and players being underrated, but him being in the top 10, and this actually leads on to sort of, I don't want to go too far into it because we spent a lot of time on other subjects as well, so probably can't give as much time as I wanted to initially, but you've said there, on FIFA at least, as a guide, he's the best player in the Premier League.
Best midfielder in the game, isn't it?
Best midfielder in the game. There you go. So that is the actual question. When does he actually become considered the best midfielder in the world?
I mean, he already is, isn't he? I think, look, everyone knows that I'm a big proponent of Busquets, and I was a big proponent of Modric before he left his soul in Russia. That's not a side thing. He just put everything for the World Cup bid. So those two were, for years, the best by some distance, right?
Modric literally was the best.
Literally was the best. I think he still literally is, right?
He still is
literally the best. So, you know, those two, the standard bearers by a million miles. Modric's fallen off big time. Busquets, he's still probably, I would argue, the best defensive midfielder, but it's very close now. There's like the players creeping up behind him because he's just starting to catch up with him. He's still phenomenal at what he does, but
yeah.
You look at what Busquets does, right? Busquets' big thing, and Modric's was, not so much anymore, is influencing a game, influencing the tempo of a game, influencing how Barcelona play. They look so much better with him on the field. Mm. De Bruyne does that for City as well. And he scores and assists.
Yeah.
Like, and you can't really, it's like the big thing I've always said about Busquets is he plays two roles at once. He's central midfielder and defensive midfielder. De Bruyne is central midfielder and right winger at the same time. He influences the way City plays, because when he plays, the way he moves into space, City are constantly on the front foot, constantly playing a high tempo. Can he control a game and slow it down like Busquets? Probably not, but he influences it in his own way, and he doesn't play the same position as Busquets anyway. And Frankie de Jong is the option, but Frankie is now adapting to Barcelona, so he's knocking back a little bit because he's not in his comfort zone at Ajax where
I would say without hesitation that De Bruyne is better than Frankie de Jong.
That's what I'm saying. So to me, I think the question is, you're saying, is he? I think, when is he become? I think he already is. I think he was basically almost there at the end of 17-18.
Injury.
And then got injured for the entire season. And then, so then it was like, oh, Modric and Busquets get reprieve. He was coming for them back then.
Yeah.
And now he's back fit, and he's there already.
He was brilliant at the World Cup as well, wasn't he? And then he started the season, and injuries twice. And we kept saying as well, even when he returned at the end of last season, though, I've not seen an injury not affect someone.
Yeah.
Like that. It was just like, oh, wait, you're still world class.
Yeah, it's just literally he was...
You've been out for a long time. Are you getting... Again, it was... Bringing it back to that Watford game, I think it was a bit silly, but he played 45 minutes and got him out of the match in an FA Cup final, despite being despite being not fully fit. He's obscenely talented, and I expect, as I said, his name will be etched into many a record book by the end of the season, because obviously he got close to Omri's assist record, which is 20, by a forward, which is just a side note on Thierry Omri. Wow.
Don't forget how good Omri was, kids.
Ozil came close.
Ozil would have broken it if Giroud hadn't stopped scoring.
Yeah,
he was like 18 on like January.
De Bruyne's the 2017-18 season was 17 assists. He's on 5 after 4 games.
And also because Sané, the interesting thing here is because Sané's out injured and he's not there, City's now, he got 17 assists before, but now they're going to change their model of play because before it was a lot of it was going through Sané playing out wide on the left. Now because he's not doing that, now Bernardo plays on the right wing, cuts in field, and Sterling plays on the right wing, cuts in field, on the left wing, sorry, and cuts in field. I think De Bruyne now has become almost like the new Sané, as well as being De Bruyne.
Well, remember that last season De Bruyne didn't play, so it was through Sané. And when they all played... They all got 10 assists each.
Yeah.
There was 4 players that had 10 assists.
It was balanced, right? So now it's like, now everything is sort of, because Sterling is now more about getting goals. I mean, he still gets assists. And Bernardo is he prepping to move to central midfield? Is he what? You know, Bernardo does everything. He's world class. So I think De Bruyne, I think he's got a very good chance to smash that record, not just break it, because he is, not only is he their central midfield hub, the guy that everything goes through, he plays right wing basically half the time.
Yeah.
And
you mentioned that he doesn't slow games down. I think De Bruyne does the opposite.
Yeah, exactly.
And when City need to, he will accelerate a game and blitz an opponent.
It's Rodri that slows their games, and that's why he's such a massive signing. But just to bring it back to Rodri real quick, because that's why he's so huge, because City do need to be able to slow games down, and they don't really have the ability to do that, and now they do with a player like Rodri. So I mean, they're just ridiculous.
Well, imagine next season, so David Silva's last season, and David Silva still himself is a very good midfielder, but imagine next season that they actually play Rodri, De Bruyne and Bernardo as their
that's
comfortably the best in the world immediately. I think given prime age as well, it's not just that they're all good players. As you said, De Bruyne is, I think, 27 going 28, so he's that's peak.
And then Bernardo and Rodri are mid-20s.
So. Bernardo, I think, just turned 25, so next season, watch out already.
This season, watch out. Next season, watch out.
But next season...
They might even sign a centre-half for next season.
They just get even better. So good luck this weekend, Norwich. You're not only just against Man City, you're against two players that are chasing records themselves.
And Raheem Sterling.
who again, is just... As we mentioned, he was directly involved in the most goals out of those three.
I mean, if you watched him against Kosovo and you think Norwich and Kosovo play kind of similarly, you're just thinking, oh, God.
Well, that was the thing, wasn't it? Kosovo were very brave and scored 3 goals, but they conceded 5.
Sterling was just dicing them up. It's going to be a blunder.
I think it was 9 take-ons, Sterling, in that game. It was unbelievable. And the best bit was that Sancho asked him the night before, please, can you square a ball for me?
Yeah.
And Sterling, in typical City fashion, squared one and then maybe tried to shoot for one of them. And it got to Sancho, but it looked like a nice little ding.
I love that Sancho, by the way, is like, you forget about how young he is, and he's like saying, please can you pass to me? Like, you're like, oh God, yeah, you are just like a child.
I think this leads quite nicely into, let's do our Premier League predictions for this weekend based off that. Because we've said that Norwich Man City is going to be a bit of a mauling, but we will do it in chronological order. And we'll start with Liverpool versus Newcastle.
I think it's just a question of how many goals will Liverpool score.
Ooh.
So I'm going
to
go
And what's your answer to that?
3 or 4. I'm going to go 3.
How many will Newcastle get?
No. 3 now.
See, I don't think Alisson's back yet, so I'm going to say, actually, I don't think Liverpool will be undercooked. Their players have gone all around the world. I think 2-1. They'll win comfortably, but I think they won't score as many as they can do. They'll dominate the game, though.
I think 3-0 as well for that one, just because Liverpool are frustratingly proving that they're an incredible side as well.
They're incredible, yeah. But don't count out Joe Linton, boys.
Yeah, Joe Linton. There we go. Brighton versus Burnley, an absolute cracker.
Definitely a draw. 1-1.
I'm going to go against the trend that Brighton are improving, because they are. I'm going to go Burnley, mate. Chris Wood has scored twice the last time played. They hasn't scored yet this season. I think he's going to be itching to go. I think they'll win 2-1.
I think this could be a 0-0, Brighton-Burnley.
Probably, but
I can just see it playing out, which wouldn't be very good for Ashley Barnes, who I put into my fantasy team finally, and I'm now backing him not to score. So prove me wrong, please, Ashley Barnes. Man United versus Leicester. Obviously, we spoke about that at length at the beginning.
I think Man U have to win, and I think they will manage to do it. So I think I'm going to go for 1-0 to Man U.
Yeah, I think they, like Tom says, they need to win. I think Leicester play into their hands 2-1. They'll have to work for it, though.
I think 2-1 Leicester on that. I just think Vardy is a new test.
Oh, yeah.
And Maguire may know him well from training, but I think Roy Keane went in on Maguire, didn't he, recently?
Roy Keane goes in on everyone.
I know, but he was saying that he's not convinced that he's quick at all.
Literally,
and I think,
Roy Keane likes Cristiano Ronaldo, and that's about it.
So I think Jamie Vardy might expose that weakness that Roy Keane prophesied in this game. 2-1 Leicester for me there. Sheffield United versus Southampton.
Yeah, this was a tough one. I think Sheffield United have been really good at home, or pretty solid, other than Leicester. So I think they're going to turn that around, and I'm going to go for 2-1 to Sheffield United.
I'm going for an old Squawker Talker football podcast favourite.
Nice.
2-2.
There we go. We had to get one in. And it's usually happened before the fourth fixture as well. So thanks for getting that in earlier, or later than usual. I think Sheffield United will win this as well, and I think they'll keep a clean sheet. I think 1-0 to Sheffield United in this one. As you said, Tom, they've been solid at home and look positive. And their second half against Chelsea was really impressive. So I think they'll translate that into 3 points there. Spurs versus Crystal Palace.
This one I'm going to go for 2-1 to Spurs. I think Tottenham are too strong for Palace, but I think Palace will put up a good fight.
Here comes the flamethrower, 1-0 Palace.
1-0 to Palace.
They're going
to
get done by Zaha on the break.
Palace's incredible away record, not only away in general, but against big teams, has also swayed me into a 2-1 Crystal Palace win. Almost a rinse and repeat of Old Trafford. They've got the formula. They've nailed it, and I think they're going to repeat it again. Wolves versus Chelsea, an interesting game.
Oh, well, I'll go for the Squawker Talker special.
3-1 Wolves.
3-1 Wolves, yeah. Is something I did not expect to hear.
They'll do what United did to
them. I was going to say, you think about it, they're going to copy and paste that. I've put 2-all as well for this one. Just because the Wolves can score based on that counter-attack, but Chelsea do keep pushing forward. So,
and Tammy Abraham's looking really good as well.
Looking really good, and then Mason Mount as well.
He scored multiple goals in consecutive games for the first time in his career.
There you go. And he's looking to make it 3 in a row.
Go for it, Tammy.
So Norwich Man City.
Why'd you put me first for this one? I'll go 4-0 to Man City.
4-0.
6-2 to Man City.
6-2. Mo's been concocting that one all week. You know, the ins and outs of 6-2. I think 5-0. 5-1. 5-1 to Man City.
Norwich are going to score. 100%.
I'm backing them to score. Bournemouth versus Everton on the Sunday.
2-1 to Everton. I think they're going to be the favourites for best of the rest, if not trying to break into the top six.
Yeah, 2-1 Everton. They showed in the last game. They've got some steel to them. Richarlison's playing well.
Yeah, I think just away they're a bit weaker, so I'm going to lean towards not 3 points and just go for a 1-1 here. I think we're yet to see Bournemouth play truly well, apart from against Man City, but you just end up losing against Man City anyway. So I think they might get a point out of this one.
David Brooks.
So Watford versus Arsenal. He's injured.
I know.
Watford versus Arsenal.
I think Arsenal will be very aware of the fact that Watford will be much more focused on defence this weekend, but I think they're going to go there and do a job and get a 1-0 win.
See, I'm going the opposite way. I think new manager bounce will help Watford, but Arsenal are still too good. So I think 2-2.
2-2.
I think we're going to see a lot of goals.
All right, so now we've done it and there's all the tools now. I think 2-1 Arsenal. I just can't imagine us getting another clean sheet away from home at the same ground. But I think Emery is working on a way to play away from home, and it could. I think it's beneficial that Watford will be hyper defensive. So I think 2-1. And then finally, Monday Night Football, saving the best till last, Claret and Blue showdown, Aston Villa West Ham.
If I wasn't a West Ham fan and I thought logically, I'd say 2-1 to West Ham. But because I am a West Ham fan...
2-1 to West Ham,
yes.
Even though you're not a West Ham fan.
No, but because I'm very pessimistic, I'm going to go for 1-0 to Aston Villa.
Oh, right. I was expecting you to go the other way around and be like, if I wasn't a West Ham fan, Aston Villa can probably win.
Well, I think based on the numbers, West Ham will win, but... Yeah, as a pessimist.
No, mate, Lanzini's creating chances everywhere. West Ham are going to ding them out of the park. 3-1 West Ham.
3-1 West Ham. I think 1-1 this one as well. Some of those will be put into our BetBall accumulator this weekend. So remember to follow us on the app if you're 18 plus and you are, please, gamble aware on that. But you can follow us on there and get some of those predictions. We'll take one final break before we move over to La Liga, because you chose on the poll to talk about Barcelona versus Valencia. So, as I mentioned, we asked you to pick which European match we would focus on this week. And fortunately for Mo, it was Barcelona versus Valencia. But
all those votes were bots at bot accounts that I
said. Yeah, exactly. He got his burners on it and sent them to work. But it actually turns out that despite me wanting to do a bit of Leipzig-Bayern Munich, it works out really well because Valencia decided to steal all the headlines in recent days by getting rid of Marcelino, the manager, replacing him with Albert Celades. And now it looks like Barcelona are playing a side in complete chaos.
I mean,
so what my main question was first, before we move on to some of the Barcelona stuff, is what happened at Valencia? Because he won them the Copa del Rey.
Yeah, so, you know, Peter Lim is good at making... essentially, Peter Lim is good at making money, not good at making football decisions. He's not a football man. He's a billionaire who wants to run a club, wants to be the big boss. Essentially, he's hired Marcelino Matteo Armani. Matteo Armani is director general, Marcelino's coach. And things were good at Valencia. They won the Copa del Rey, first time since 2008. They play good football. They've got good players. Armani is very good at signing players. And Lim is like, oh, I want more control of a transfer. So it blew up in the summer, in July. First, and there was rumours that were swirling that Armani was about to resign because of falling out with Lim over transfers. Lim was like, oh, no, I want the final say. And, you know, like rumoured about the signings of Rafinha and Denis Suarez, that Marcelino wanted those two, and Lim was like, no, you're not having them, basically. So, and then, but they both ended up at Celta Vigo, where Denis Suarez in particular has started the season very well. So, Lim didn't want those guys. Lim didn't sign off. So Armani tried to walk away in the summer, tried to walk away in July. And then hearing this, Marcelino was like, well, I'm going to walk away too. And the Valencia players were like, no, you're not. What are you talking about? You're not leaving, because they love him. They believe in his project. They're big Marcelino fans. And so once they heard that, the fans who also love Marcelino got involved. And this whole groundswell of support, Peter Lim was like, oh, okay, I didn't realise that. Maybe I won't do anything, and sort of backed off, and everything sort of calmed down. It's like, oh, all good. But it wasn't all good. The issue was never solved. Lim still wants control over transfers. And then I think it's just ultimately the Denis Suarez was done earlier. But Rafinha was in play until the last day of the window. I think Marcelino still wanted to get him, hopefully. I mean, I think he's gone on record saying about his squad being short. So he wanted to get Rafinha. Rafinha ended up at Celta Vigo. And I think basically the fallout from that is probably that he's like, what are you doing again? I told you I need this player. We needed this guy. We need this body in midfield. And he said, well, it's too bad. And he sacked him. It's purely an ego thing. Celades is the replacement. Celades is not a good coach. If anyone watched Spain at the under-21s, that team was built purely on individual genius. The talent that was in the squad. And there's a lot of talent in that squad. The coaching was non-existent. They weren't a well-coached team. He's not a good coach.
And this is 2017, highlight. Because they obviously won the under-20 Euros. This team to the final under Celades and lost to Germany.
Yeah, so that, you know, he's not a good coach. Could he become one? Who the hell knows, honestly? But it's just such... He's such a non-event of a coach. Like, Marcelino had a real plan, a real vision. They played such good football. They beat Barcelona. They deservedly beat Barcelona in the Copa del Rey. It wasn't like they nicked a couple of goals and hung on for it. They were the better team for the whole game. And then the goals were beautiful. They worked the ball up the play. It wasn't just quick counter-attacks. They outplayed Barcelona and deservedly won the Copa del Rey final. They were progressing in the right direction. It's such a bad decision. It's so bad.
And that was the thing. And so... to sort of double down on the Rafinha, Denis Suarez, Sport did a big sort of reveal of after the sacking of that was the main reason why. Marcelino, the quotes were that the club has told me Rafinha won't be coming, my squad is now left short. So there was just obviously clear resentment in who had control over building that squad. And as you said, Marcelino with whoever was building that squad, and maybe they had more say to start with, ended up doing really, really well with Valencia and actually took them on to a completely new level, obviously got them back into the Champions League, Tom, were you looking at some of the progression? And
well,
what happened?
You could say that in a sense, for a while after Valencia got rid of Nuno Espirito Santo, they really became the Spanish Watford. They had six managers in the space of 3 years, one including the infamous Gary Neville. And then that included two 12th place finishes after Espirito Santo, or after their fourth place finish the season before that. So Marcelino almost came in, steadied the ship at Valencia, brought in stability, got them those two fourth place finishes. And like you said, he seemed to have a plan of action. He was constructing a really nice squad. The players all believed in him. And then due to what can only be looked at as Peter Lim's large ego and the need to be in the spotlight and to be seen as the one who saved Valencia as opposed to Marcelino, he's gotten rid of him. So, and very worrying.
Ezequiel Garay did an Instagram post on Marcelino after he'd left this week and finished with, in capitals, "No es justo." So he's clearly upset.
Yeah,
and that's... It's one thing changing your manager and looking for a new thing, but now if the players resent that decision being made, you will get some that don't feel like they want to represent the club. They are human after all.
Look at Spain at the World Cup, and that's Spain, that's your country as well. Look at how progressively bad they got, how much worse they got with every passing game of the day away from Julen Lopetegui, because they didn't want change. They didn't want Hierro in charge. They wanted their manager.
Yeah. Who again had done so well?
They were going to win the World Cup, man. Yeah. I don't know what that was—the stupidest thing, anyway. But anyway, look, whatever. That was in the past. Look, Valencia. It was a mammoth task, anyway, going to the Camp Nou, playing Barcelona, right, against a team that, you know.
Well, no Messi,
but like still players that play well against them: Luis Suarez, Antoine Griezmann. You know, I mean, still a lot of talent there. Ansu Fati looks really promising. Barca need Messi back. I mean, Messi's been in the press today in Sport again, firing some shots, saying that he doesn't think Barca did everything they could do to sign Neymar. So he's pretty clear. He's saying, go back in and sign him, please.
Yeah. Well, we'll have to wait into at least January now.
Yeah. I mean, but you can see he wanted Neymar very much, and Neymar wanted to come. I think
it's almost like Neymar's a good player as well.
It is, isn't it? Yeah. It's strange about it.
If Lionel Messi wants you back. I mean, he must be half decent.
Exactly. No, look, it was always going to be tough for Valencia going to the Camp Nou anyway, and now it's going to be even more so. Because for all their struggles in the away games, which are mostly built around just some bad luck, really. Like, in terms of the opposition being about finishing worldies, like you look at the goals from Torres and from Adarith, and like. Not 8 times out of 10 those goals aren't going in. And so look, don't get me wrong, they've disappointed as well. Valverde hasn't been at his best, PK hasn't been at his best, Alba's been a bit rickety, but you could look at it and you're like, 9 times out of 10 those goals don't go in, but so whatever. But at home they look very good. Griezmann is obviously sensational. Ansu Fati coming in is going to add a lot, I think. Arthur coming back is going to add a lot. I mean, we only saw half an hour of him in last time, so now they're going to have a whole game of him, probably. He's probably going to start. Arthur, Frenkie de Jong's going to continue his adaptation. So,
well, Frenkie de Jong got his first Netherlands goal.
I mean, that was interesting to see him go push that far forward. And
well, that's
what
he's being asked to do. There was one moment, I can't remember which Barcelona game it was, where he found himself in the box and it was like, you literally should shoot. And he sort of passed it. Yeah. And that was the sort of, oh no, why are you getting Frankie de Jong in the box? That's where he's not very good. He took that goal with ice cool composure.
It is. So I do wonder, like, I imagine that the Rakitic, now that he's staying, isn't going to be involved in any swap deal with PSG. I think Rakitic will probably come back into the team. So I would imagine what we'll see Busquets and de Jong, and then Rakitic as the most advanced midfielder, which is funny because we think of him as like this workhorse, solid defensive midfielder guy, but he was number 10 for Sevilla. Mm. He was very good number 10. So I think maybe he'll go far forward and then Arthur will come off the bench or something. But yeah, I would imagine now Barca, as a result of that, Suarez might be fit. I'm not sure. Griezmann, obviously. Carlos Perez is playing very well. Ansu Fati, as we mentioned. So I think they'll have too much for Valencia. Now, if Marcelino had been there...
Yeah, this is what I was going to say. Barcelona would have been going, phew.
That would have been
the guy that masterminded the Copa del Rey defeat is gone. Yeah. And as you sort of alluded to there, Tom, saying that they're the La Liga's Watford, Watford might have been thinking, ugh. We waited another day.
I mean,
we might have been able to hire Marcelino, because as everyone, the overwhelming reaction to this managerial change is what are you doing, Valencia? You have a really, really good manager. So now there is a really, really good manager that is not managing a club.
Someone in the Premier League needs to be like, hey, you want to come here?
Yeah, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is probably the most under fire manager at the moment.
If he wasn't an absolute beloved fan favourite, he would be really sweating bullets right now. He knows he will have a season, at least, unless he's a complete disaster.
Yeah.
He will have a season. It's because he's Solskjaer and he's a legend. Well,
and they want him to oversee this transition in which they're perceived to be not very good. Yeah. So if Solskjaer takes all the flack for that, then it's it's fine.
He is more bulletproof because he is Solskjaer. Yeah. But I think if he wasn't like a fan favourite, he would be terrified right now, because Marcelino is a better coach than he is by some order of magnitude. So... Marcelino would improve any coach except for the top four and Leicester, I would argue.
And obviously, Brendan Rodgers doesn't look like he's going anywhere. No, he's not. Anyway,
I'm just saying, I would take Marcelino. He's Unai Emery level. I would put him on that level with Unai Emery. I would take him over anyone. Yeah, he's phenomenal.
Well, there we go. Watch out for a Marcelino coming to a club near you soon. But that is all we do have time for this week. As I said, remember, the BetBall Accumulator will be on in the description below the podcast at the end. And it leads me just to say, Tom, thank you very much for coming on.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Put your tin hat on for the FIFA songs ranking article that you're on the way. Mo, thank you for coming on, as always.
As always, it's been a pleasure.
Tin hat's permanently on you,
well,
isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just out there in full body armor, like, come on.
And thank you, listeners, for joining us. How exciting.